Well, of course, it all began in 1927 when a number of people founded the society, which is usually called the German Rocket Society. Its real name was Verein für Raumschifffahrt, which means Society for Space Travel. I must say that our sights were set high from the very outset. This society was founded in 1927, as I mentioned, but did not start experimenting until 1929. And just as the door to actual experimentation was opened, a new man appeared on the scene, namely Wernher von Braun. You remember how we met?
Yes, Willie. I left school in the spring of 1930, and I had read everything by then that had been published in the space field, including your own books. So it was only natural for me that I try to get in contact with you and with the other people who had been active in this field before in order to make myself useful. And I remember well how I visited you in your home in Berlin and asked me to accept me in the rocket team and get me in contact in particular with Professor Obert, who
yes.
was all our mentor at that time.
Of course, Obert had written the important theoretical book. I believe it was a rainy afternoon. I know it was an afternoon, and I think it was a rainy afternoon. My memory has this dimly in its background. What I do remember clearly is that I was not in at the moment you arrived, and you passed the time playing the piano, and I've told many audiences since that what you played was the first movement of the Moonlight Sonata.
So I must have been moonstruck even then.
You were moonstruck even then. Now, I'm not talking as a music critic. I don't know how well you played it, but that's what you played.
Yeah, I remember.
And then, from then on, of course...
I remember that my first activity in practical rocketry was to assist Obert and the other members of the German Society of Space Travel to put an exhibit into one of the big department stores in Berlin.
Yes.
There was a gyroscope in that exhibit and a mock-up of a rocket which Obert had proposed to build and several components.
A little launching rack?
Yes, a little launching rack. And
which looked very big then. It was probably all of 15 feet tall,
yes.
And compared to a gentry of today, you wouldn't see it, but it looked large then.
One of the pieces that impressed me most was a very rudimentary little rocket motor that Obert had used in his early experiments in Neubabelsburg by the UFA Film Company. You remember he...
The so-called Kegeldüse.
Yes, Obert services had been secured by UFA, helping as an advisor on their motion picture, The Girl in the Moon. Remember?
Yes.
Frau im Mond.
Frau im Mond. Fritz Lang did this. I know a little more about this. It was started late in 1928, in fall of 1928. Fritz Lang was then married to the novelist Thea von Harbou, who had written the book. And at first they had Max Valier in mind as a scientific advisor because he was doing most of the newspaper writing and his name was known. For some reason, Fritz Lang decided that Max Valier was not the man for him and he wanted somebody better. And so he wrote a long letter to Professor Obert, who then lived in Romania. And at the last moment, Fritz Lang changed his mind in one respect. He had the letter sent as a telegram. It was several pages long. And then Obert came to Berlin. And while the filming was going on, and Obert gave all this advice, we started talking. By we, I mean myself largely. To Lang whether the premiere of the movie could not be combined with an actual rocket shot.
Wasn't it so, Willie, that originally Fritz Lang offered Obert a very substantial remuneration for his services, and Obert said, well, I would rather see you finance some rocket tests that I would like to make with that money. And when Lang saw these big flames shooting through his
studios,
yeah, then he was so impressed. He said, now let's get crack and build a rocket. And can't we synchronize the firing of that rocket with our first premiere show of the movie?
Well, Lang's saying so made it official, you know. Yeah. Obert himself had taken about half of his salary and put it aside for experimental purposes.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And half of it he used up to live and to support his family. The other half he put aside. The whole thing then fizzled in some respect. Obert had put his money in that he had saved for the purpose. Fritz Lang had put a substantial sum in, 26,000 German marks or something like this. And the company was supposed to put the same amount in, but didn't, and did not reimburse Fritz Lang, who actually financed the first liquid fuel rocket tests in Germany that way. Mm-hmm. Somewhat inadvertently, but he did. And the item you remember from the exhibit in the department store was the so-called Kegeldüse.
That's right.
The first European liquid fuel rocket motor.
Now, I was present when that Kegeldüse was fired up for the first time. It was in the summer of 1930 on the grounds of the Chemisch Technische Reichsanstalt in Berlin, which
yes.
is a kind of
something
Bureau
like,
of Standards.
Like our Bureau of Standards.
Proving grounds. They had offered Obert to work in their open area, in the explosive area. And I remember this Kegeldüse was mounted with a nozzle upside, so the jet would shoot upwards into a bucket that was filled with water, and that water served for cooling the motor. And there was a little gasoline tank and a little oxygen tank. We worked with liquid oxygen even then.
I know. I was there.
And
I was only a spectator. You worked there, but I was there.
I worked as an apprentice mechanic. So
yes, yes. I was there too as a spectator.
Mm.
And now this time I know it was a rainy day.
Yes, yes.
We always had to run for a shelter and then...
Well, I remember the very first test with that Kegeldüse that was successful was prepared something like this. We had an old oil-drenched rag that was mounted at the end of a long pole. And Klaus Riedel, you know,
yes,
had to open the valves. No, I had to open the valves, and Klaus Riedel had to... put that burning petrol-soaked rug over the motor while I was opening the valves, and then Klaus had to jump back behind cover before the thing exploded or lit up. And after several tests, it started with a big bang, and then we had a run of about 90 seconds duration where, if I remember correctly, 7 kilograms of thrust
what?
Produced. Several years earlier, namely in 1926, Robert Goddard had already free flight fired a liquid fuel rocket. We thought we were the first in the world.
Oh, yes, we were convinced we were, because Goddard had done this in March 26, but hadn't published it until 36.
Yes.
And in this 10-year interval, of course, every little success that we had, we proudly considered a first in history.
Yes.
Now then, after the experiment with Obert's Kegeldüse, didn't you then go to Switzerland to study for a while?
Wait a minute. Obert left us in the fall of 1930 after this German Bureau of Standards had certified him
yes.
that the Kegeldüse had performed, had
yeah.
produced these 7 kilograms of thrust for 90 seconds. His leave from his school in Romania expired, and he decided that he had to go home. His resources were used up, but he had achieved what one could expect under the circumstances. And then in fall 1930, his main assistant at that time, Rudolf Nebel, said, "Let's continue this. I think rocketry is a great thing, and the old man is now going back to Romania, but we don't want this thing to die on the vine here."
Yes.
And So Nebel went to a little window shopping in the area, northern Berlin, for a suitable terrain where we could conduct rocket experiments. And high-pressure salesman that he was, he managed to talk the city administration of Reinickendorf out of about 300 acres of an old abandoned munitions dump or whatever it was.
It had been a munitions dump during the First World War.
And all he paid for, if I remember, was 1 mark registration fee for the deal.
And then 1 mark per month, a quarter a month rent.
I see. Uh-huh. Well, that was, of course, outrageous.
It was outrageous. And the reason why he got this so cheap was that it had been an ammunition dump. You know, all the buildings were surrounded by high earth walls. And although the land belonged to the city, the buildings belonged to the army, who would not let anybody touch those earth walls.
I see.
So it was unsaleable and unrentable.
Anyway, in the fall of 30, we thereupon started scrounging around for equipment that was put in there.
Yes.
And in early 1931, the first rocket motors were fired up in this on these grounds. And I remember that you were present there several times.
Oh, yes, I was on quite often. As a matter of fact, I often was on when you were not, you know.
Yes. Well, you were actually with the you were vice president of the parent organization of the society, so speaking. We were just the field engineers.
Well, I was vice president, and for a long time there was no president, which made my position quite strange. This design there, this of course was no longer Obert's Kegeldüse, but was this more rounded motor that we used to call the goose egg and names like that. Was that your design?
No, this was mainly Klaus Riedel's design.
Well, mainly Klaus Riedel's.
The thing had a very funny history. The way we operated in those days was that Nebel would come home in the evening and say, "Look at here, I talked one company into giving us these sheets of aluminum, this is the material we have, so now let's build a rocket motor." And so
do something with it.
You virtually designed the rocket motor around the material that Nebel managed to
to
scrounge.
Yes.
And another problem then was that we had no aluminum welders in our group, and so what Nebel did was that I remember on one of these fishing expeditions, he talked a director of the Siemens company out of a sizable amount of steel welding wire, for which we had, of course, no use whatsoever. But with that welding wire in his trunk, he drove to a welding institute and told them, "If you would weld our rocket motors for free with your good aluminum welders, then you can keep this welding wire." So we operated on an essentially cash-free basis and really got the job done.
Yes. Yes, and then there were the first rocket flights. As a matter of fact, some had parachute recovery.
That was a little later. I left for Zurich, Switzerland in summer 31 for about 6 months. And when I came back, the first rockets were about ready to fly with a parachute in the tail.
You saw, of course, flights with parachute recovery.
Oh, lots of them.
Yes.
Lots of them.
Yes.
I think a total of 85 of these rockets.
85 or 87, I think 87. I remember, because one of my duties was to write the monthly bulletin. And for this reason, I remember these figures somewhat better than you do, because I had to write them down.
Of course, it would be kind of misleading if we say now with that little money we fired 87 liquid fuel rockets in the day, it costs $1 million to get one off the ground. Maybe we should add here that these rockets were rather rudimentary.
Yeah, they were no Redstones and no Jupiters.
I remember we used an old tire pump to inflate to pressurize the fuel tank.
Yes.
And the LOX tank was merely pressurized by filling it only 30% and then waiting long enough for evaporation to build up pressure that would provide the pressurization. When the pressure was just right, then we would open the valves, and then if everything went well, the rocket motor fired up and it would get out of the rack.
Yes, I remember in one specific type it took 3 minutes and 45 seconds for the oxygen tank to pressurize itself.
Yeah. Well, Klaus Riedel had a girlfriend,
yes,
and she used to to sew the parachutes, remember?
Yes.
She, I think she had worked as a seamstress for a while or something. At any rate, she knew quite well how to make the little parachutes.
Yeah, well, she had been working in the garment industry, partly as a seamstress, partly as a model.
I see. Uh-huh. So she was very pretty, I remember.
Yeah, and she knew how to put a parachute together. Yes.
And we stuck that parachute into an empty can.
Yes.
And it was expelled by means of a little piston and an explosive charge in the rear.
Yes, it was a cork piston. Yeah. A cork piston with a little black powder to expel it. Hmm. Yeah, and then one of these rockets, one of the bigger types, which needed both hands to lift up, the smaller types could be lifted by a strong man with one hand, then was demonstrated to the German army.
Yeah, I remember one case before we get to that,
yes,
incidentally, that Klaus Riedel caught one of these rockets as it parachuted back to the ground in mid-air while standing in the rear of the automobile. In other words, that thing was coming down very close to the launching site, and he, another fellow drove that car right into the pasture there, with Klaus Riedel trying to grab that rocket out of the air before it hit the ground, would get injured.
Yes.
And he really caught it there. It was fired the next day again.
I heard that story. I wasn't present when this was done, but I know this was accomplished. So all the things that you now have in headlines were done by us then on a small scale.
Yes.
And sometimes successfully.
Yeah.
Now, then one of the bigger rockets, the ones that you needed both hands to lift, was demonstrated to the German army. On that occasion, I was not present.
Well, they drove up, they had witnesses, I think, several tests. They were always coming in civilian clothes and were just watching.
Well, these demonstrations at the testing field, of course, were used to make some money. Engineering societies and other interested people paid 1 mark each to watch a demonstration. And as we learned later on, there must have been German army personnel, not in uniform, of course, who paid 1 mark to look at all these things. Isn't that how it came about?
Yes. I remember that among the many visitors we had, there were three men in mufti who came in and what looked like a military car with civilian license plates on, and they were greatly interested in what we were doing. And I remember that after a demonstration of one of our little water-cooled motors on the captive test stand, they invited us to give them a free-flight demonstration on the Army Proving Ground in Kummersdorf.
Yeah, that was one of the long, long ones where the two tanks were on the same axis, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yes, one after the other.
Yeah.
This is called Stark Repulsor.
The one stick repulsor, yes.
Well, that demonstration took place in the June of 1932, and it wasn't quite successful. The missile took off all right from the launcher, but having no guidance, and having a pretty stiff wind blowing, it veered into the wind, flew horizontal at an altitude of something like 500 to 800 feet, and crashed into the woods about 2 miles from the launching site.
And what happened to the parachute?
I think the parachute was still in its casing when it hit the ground because the total flight time wasn't long enough.
Oh, I see. So that
the timing
mechanism never had a chance to go into action and throw it out.
Yes.
Well, and this then was the demonstration which was, in a way, the seed from which everything else...
Yes, what happened thereafter was that we, of course, considered the thing a success as far as the demonstration of a liquid fuel rocket in flight was concerned, but the Army wasn't so enthusiastic because we hadn't really delivered the goods and promised what we thought we could do, namely reach an altitude of several miles and then land the thing by parachute. Nevertheless, the Army was impressed. But they said they didn't like the loud publicity that surrounded our testing field there, and so they said they would support rocket development, the continuation of our liquid rocket development, only if we would accept their terms and move the whole operation behind the fence of an army post.
Yes.
Well, over the wisdom of accepting or not accepting this offer, I had a little argument with Mr. Nebel, as you will remember.
Yes, I know.
He felt that we were in a position to impose our conditions on them, and I thought that we were just completely broke, and if we wanted to continue anything, we had to accept it.
And Nebel should have realized that the one who has the money is the one who makes the conditions, not the one who is right.
That's the way it seems to be. At any rate, the consequence of the whole thing was that I myself accepted an offer by the Army to work in Kumarstov on their proving ground on the development of rockets, whereas Nebel continued to work in on the Reinickendorf field for another 2 years until he was finally so broke that he had to give up.
Yes, until the whole thing collapsed.
Yes.
Essentially for lack of cash.
Yes.